The Progressive Commentary Hour with Gary Knoll, Mondays at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour, where we select a single theme and one or more panelists to discuss it in depth. Nothing is rushed, no interruptions, more of a contemplation on an issue, examining the context of our thoughts, not just the symptoms of a society that is living almost pathologically on all levels. Today, continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds, we'll be talking with Professor Charlene Spretnik on green politics, a relational view of contemporary society and politics, the future of spirituality's role in a future social paradigm. Little heady, yes. In depth, you bet. And one of the nice things about this particular hour is if it should go over, so be it. Last week we spent 7.5 hours on one topic, an in-depth original investigation and debate on the politics behind the excoriation and defamation of Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Since that time, that information has been shared by tens of thousands of people who would not have otherwise known all the complexities, nuances, and many people now see that he is indeed a victim of the witch hunt perpetuated by Rupert Murdoch and his newspaper empire in the British Medical Journal, and Mr. Deere, his chief attacker. Today, however, we're going to take a different approach to our topic. We're going to begin with an overview by my guest in a moment of what's wrong with the way we're perceiving reality and what do we need to do to correct it. For those of you who are not familiar with Charlene Spretnak, she is an internationally recognized postmodern visionary and author among the first wave of originators of what is now commonly known as ecofeminism and feminine spirituality. Her writings have focused on such diverse subjects as social justice, postmodern culture, ecological philosophy, and green politics, feminism and spirituality and theology. Her book, Green Politics, co-written with Fritjof Capra, established the platform for the American Green Party, which Charlene co-founded. Her book, The Resurgence of the Real, was chosen as Best Book of the Year by the Los Angeles Times. Her most recent book is Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness that are Transforming the Modern World, which challenges the older mechanistic view of the universe and society. Nice to have you back with us today, Charlene.
Thank you.
Charlene, an extended question here. Much of our conversation will be centered around the different ways people perceive their social, political, and economic realities, and how these views condition the different ways people act and behave and find the belief of and for meaning and purpose in a world, as well as in their communities and groups that they identify with. The vast majority of our institutions, though are rewarded because they are dominant, receive the most recognition, ergo funding and influence, and are based upon determinist mechanistic views of reality. The integral logic of these institutions, such as the ideologies of our two main political parties, the American drug-based medical establishment, the theory of radical neoliberal free market capitalism or globalization, and even our policies on energy, pollution, and clean water are fundamentally linear and almost primitive in their causative rationale. So before we go into the specifics of today's system of governance and green politics and economic theories and social policies and spiritual ways of perceiving our postmodern world, Would you please summarize for us the kind of psychological and spiritual view that is hidden behind the present mechanistic view of our modern world? Then please introduce us to the alternative view, which you call relational reality, which is based upon that interconnected, co-independent view of the many systems that relate to each other that need to be recognized and honored before any real solutions to problems can be identified.
Well, we'll have to start with the foundations of the modern worldview, because that's what shaped the status quo. And we really inherited the effects of the mechanistic worldview, which came out of the scientific revolution in the 16th and 17th century. And within 100 years, all of our institutions had been redesigned to fit the mechanistic model. That's during the 18th century. So then it was all set and shaped what happened in the 19th and 20th century. Jumping ahead a little bit, I believe we can now reshape them again, because so much post-mechanistic evidence and discoveries have been made that was a faulty model. It was a faulty model because it assumed that everything operates on mechanistic principles, and you can just treat any problem like a machine, and to study it, reduce it down to its parts, and that's how you understand things. So modern medicine is based on the biomechanical model of the body. A part might break, but maybe we can replace the part or something like that. And the modern theory of economics was a matter of cogs and wheels, different spheres that have some interaction with each other and must not be regulated, or the cogs and wheels would be disturbed. So that set us off in a way that is anti-relational and not at all in sync with the way the natural world, including humans, actually function. And the recent version of this that we have had given as the rationale for every wrong act that's been passed through legislative bodies and imposed elsewhere is this modern idea of efficiency. Well, we have to centralize. We have to centralize all the production of agriculture, the production of cows, chickens, everything in these giant CAFOs, because it's a matter of efficiency of scale. And we have to close down local schools and centralize. Everything is, when you centralize, it's just a matter of clear efficiency. There's no argument. This is the modern way. Well, the idea of efficiency was, you might say, a front, because it was horribly inefficient. Industrial agriculture is horribly inefficient in terms of all the damage it does to our bodies, and all the misery and all the medical costs, all the damage it does to the soil and the air and the water, and the public has to pay for all that cleanup. So the only people it's working for were those big companies that were centralizing ownership of agriculture, and the remaining farmers all having to work as contract workers now for those few big corporations in each sector of the agricultural economy. So again and again, efficiency was put forth in a way that didn't at all perceive the gestalt around it and all the relationships. And of course, the people who were set to profit from this centralizing of ownership and capitalization, they weren't the slightest bit interested in all the ramifications. But now that they have built up to such a pitch, I mean, the damage done by having those kind of blinders on, you know, what is efficiency, the way the big money powers define it, versus the actual reality on the ground, we're really seeing a critical mass say, this is not working. There is something so wrong with the system. So we know that it's been very difficult to change the system because the same big money people who are benefiting by the destructive centralization of capital, which skews democracy horribly, they're also, of course, making the big darn contributions to lawmakers at every level. So the system we have now without campaign finance reform is almost entirely corrupt on every vote. There's no possibility that the public can get the votes that it needs, the bills, the laws that it needs, if they go against what the big donors want. And that's why everything's just paralyzed in terms of a corrective effort. But that's changing, too. And we could see from the Occupy Wall Street movement and all the inspiring ramifications of that, Occupy the Courts now is happening, that there are lots of ways to move on this. And there's a lot of public support behind it. So I would say that the green analysis and the green vision is an eco-social perspective. It brings together the ecological and the social. You know, we are human body, minds, organisms in nature, and we're social beings. We're profoundly interrelated with the natural world and with other people in ways that we don't even understand because of the blinders that the modern mechanistic worldview had on medicine, physiology, education, every field, really. So I find it rather exciting, and that's why I wrote Relational Reality, because all these discoveries in the last 10 years are really demonstrating how profoundly interrelated we are. Go ahead.
Okay, I appreciate your overview. I'd like to share with you a perspective and then get your feedback on it, if you would, please.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have oversimplified our arguments in the general society, specifically the Occupy movement. We hear polls saying that a certain percentage of 50% or more or less at any given time support the Occupy movement, but the entire Occupy movement represents under 0.01% of the American population. So what kind of support is that really? I also hear people say there's 99 and 1. And then I have to ask, is the 99% on the side of angels, the 1% on the side of the devil, when it comes to the food we eat, obesity in children that is put there not by the 1% alone, but by the 99%? Who's creating these disease states? Who's buying houses they shouldn't have because they can't afford? Who's drinking? Who's doing drugs? Who's exploiting slave labor in other countries so they can buy a cheap product in an American box store? Who is losing their job, or family members lose a job to outsourced companies and then turn around and buy the very product they would otherwise have made, and buy that where cheap exploited labor has been made? Who watches the television shows that downgrade ethics, morality, spirituality, the very things that you have spent your life and others working to enlighten us on, but choose not to have that? Good news is bad business. Bad news is good business. If it bleeds, it leads. So yesterday I was lecturing and I said, let's stop for a moment and say, what if we didn't any longer, as of today, in this argument, what if we chose not to blame Wall Street and Goldman Sachs and this greed-based and selfish mind that would rather exploit all of us if it could without ever really risking anything, because it has the Federal Reserve to bail it out. So there are really no downside to the risks they take if they fail, and we've seen that. Then let's not blame Big Pharma for creating diseases frequently that do not exist, like social anxiety disorder. And let's not blame them for over-medicating our children or making them pathologies to exploit them, like over-vaccinating them or over-medicating them. Let's also not blame the doctors for pathologizing pregnancy or menopause, which they have done. Let's also stop blaming medicine for being the number one cause of death over 700,000 dead who otherwise wouldn't have been from mistakes in medicine, iatrogenesis, or injury. Let's also don't blame the DuPonts or the major biotechnology companies for creating genetically engineered seeds like Monsanto and putting their people in policymaking positions in the Obama and Bush administration. Let's stop blaming them for giving us genetically engineered food. Let's also stop blaming all the people in big oil, big gas, clean coal, nuclear, which we all know is safe and green and harmless. And let's stop blaming them let's stop blaming the lobbyists and the contractors, the military-industrial spy complex. Let's stop blaming those people who have eviscerated our constitutional rights. Let's stop the blame. Let's stop blaming Bill O'Reilly on one side, or Laura Ingraham and Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow. Let's stop blaming the official left and the official right that have excluded any third-party discussions and haven't had Ralph Nader on, who I just had on the other day. Let's not blame them anymore for their biases or the New York Times that has never found a conspiracy that's not officially condemned to actually follow up on. Let's not blame anyone that pollutes the environment because they're making profit by not cleaning up after themselves. Let's not blame people for buying Fiji water that has to go 8,000 miles before you drink it and then throw the bottle away and it ends back up in the Pacific somewhere near Fiji. Let's not blame them anymore. Let's stop blaming parents that knowingly give their children junk food. Let's not blame the parents that knowingly don't know how to share a real parent-child relationship, that the child grows up both respective and with some sense of caring for the larger society they're in instead of selfish and narcissistic. Let's stop blaming all these people. Let's stop blaming teachers who are illiterate or teaching curriculums that should never have been in a school system. Let's stop blaming the system itself for wanting to graduate students that can pass a grade but cannot succeed at anything in life because they're functionally illiterate. So if we stop blaming all this and we stop blaming the ideologues and the ideologies they ascribe to, the Christian right for its radical principles on pro-war and anti-humanistic behavior, what are we left with if we have no one else to blame? Who's there? Who's looking back if we can no longer say we're the victims of everything? That's my question for you.
Well, I think the point that the Occupy Wall Street with the 99% and versus the 1% idea was introducing into the public consciousness, although they didn't exactly make this entirely clear, was you might blame the tax code because a tremendous amount of money was moved up, and when the rich didn't have to pay a very big chunk of their taxes with the Reagan tax cuts, and then again, 20 years later, when George W. Bush did the same thing, the second round of big tax cuts for the rich, every time the United States tax code was changed that way, it blew a big hole in all the government budgets, not only at the federal level, but so many state income tax rates are pegged to the federal.
I understand what you're saying.
Wait, let me just say, and so we now have a situation, and I'm rather pained that people don't understand this. Why is the student debt loan higher than the American credit card debt amount? That's astounding. That happened because when the rich didn't have to pay that big amount, it blew a hole in the revenue streams, and the state universities weren't getting money. They had to keep increasing the tuition, increasing the tuition, increasing the tuition. So people now in this country, it used to be that if you were smart but didn't have money, you could go through the public system, community colleges and then your state university. They're locked out now, and they're locked out, and all kinds of other problems are shut down because there's a big hole in the revenue streams, and we have to repair that hole in the revenue streams. I just read something yesterday where people said, oh, no, I don't want to put any extra taxes on the rich. I just want fair opportunity for my people down here in the working class. Well, that's how you used to have that opportunity, is when they were paying their fair share of taxes, we had public programs that opened the door
92% tax at one time when you and I were going to school. I agree with that, but that's one part. That didn't really.
It's not as big a net as you cast, but it's a very big one with the revenue streams.
I understand. But look at let's go back. I intentionally mockingly disdain all of those different entities I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are not addressing any of them. And though the Occupy Wall Street, and I was down there for 28 days, I've given them a radio show, I've interviewed them. For 28 days, when I was down there, I kept finding the same challenge. A person who says they're against having a $1 trillion student loan that starts the moment you're out of college to increase, and if you don't miss a payment, you have to pay compounding interest. But because of bankruptcy laws being written by Chris Dodd and those who were pro-banking lobbyists, it benefits the bankers because you can't get out of that debt. And you're right, it's $893 billion on credit cards, but not on student loans. But both are the same phenomena. Why can't the students who are there say, we're going back to our universities? I interviewed probably 80% of them came from local universities like Rutgers, and join others and go on a general strike. Go on a strike to not go to school and not pay any back of the, and get your parents behind you, because they probably co-sign on this. Say, we as a nation of students and supporting teachers and the unions that support those teachers, we are going on a general strike until these interest payments, these late payments, these compounding fees are forgiven. Our interest rate is 1%. We are allowed to declare bankruptcy as any human would be in any other financial crisis so we can resolve these. But until such time there's that unifying force, then there's nothing going to get done. They can pop up an issue that is completely legitimate, as you rightly have shown, but until such time we exercise, and then I would ask someone, and I did this, it was a little embarrassing, but I took off my shirt. I took off my undershirt. I opened up the back of my pants. I said, look at the labels that I'm wearing. Look at my shoes. Look at everything on me. All of this is made in the USA from union or living wage workers. And then I said, have you looked where your clothes are made? No. All of them were made in China or Bangladesh. And I said, but you're wearing something that was made for 14 cents an hour from Bangladesh, 980 million garments. Do you feel at all a passion to say no more of this? I looked in their wallets. One woman showed me her wallet, too. She had 9 credit cards, all from the very banks that she's there protesting. I said, isn't it a little confusing if you say you're against Bank of America, where we, Chris Hedges and all of us, just made a human chain around, right? We rallied against Bank of America. Take your money out of Bank of America. Put it in credit unions. And yet here were all of their monies and credit cards in the very banks they're against. They were eating McDonald's, drinking Coca-Cola, smoking cigarettes from major brands, wearing all the later designers. And I said, if you're really against the globalization and the politics and money and politics and corporatization, which part are you actually willing to give up? And that was my concern, because at a different time with different movements, the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, people actually were willing to make sacrifices that showed they were not in it just as an idealistic intention. They were really emerged. That's what I'm asking. So if we can stop blaming everyone else in the world, at what level do we individually and then collectively take responsibility for creating the shift that you're asking? Because if we don't do it, then there won't be any reform in politics. There won't be any money coming out. There won't be any PAC stop. There won't be any way to change the system. Hence, we'll just adapt right back into it. Your thoughts, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think when you said if they don't have an organized block, that's the key. You know, what is what happens next? And they say they don't want to go into electoral politics. That's fine, because a very strong, well-organized grassroots movement could control large blocks of votes, and that's the only thing that gets the attention of the people in power. But I often thought when I was listening to interviews with the Occupy people and how they didn't want to be associated with the party, and I said, the issues you're identifying have been in the Green platform for decades. Just tear off the front cover and you'll have an analysis of what you're talking about, as well as positive corrective efforts that we could all be making. So yeah, I totally agree that if it stays dispersed, we won't get what we need to get. But the other thing that's happening now is there's a move to shut down even little quarters where third-party ideas can get into the forums of government.
And what do they fear that that demands they shut them down? Before you answer that, please, let me just extend my thought a moment here, because it's something that you, I believe, will relate very personally to. Mm-hmm. I voted for Ralph Nader twice. I knew he would lose, and I knew he would lose by a landslide loss. At the very time I was trying to encourage people to vote for him, they said, if you vote for Nader, then you're voting to allow the Republicans. And I said, you don't understand. I'm not voting for Democrats or Republicans because I see no difference. When I looked at the complete detailed background, over a 400-page report I did to circulate on the background of Al Gore and what he supported. Did he promote environmental issues when he was in office, or did he compromise on environmental issues as Clinton did? I have every single law that they were involved in. I mean, real scholarship. And I said, do you know this about Al Gore? No, we didn't know that. And I went through each and every one of these. I said, when Rwanda was happening, did you hear Al Gore go into President Clinton and say, look, there's real genocide here. The whole world is recognizing genocide. Why aren't you and stopping it? Did he go to the UN and say, let us go in and protect the people there? He did not. I did the same thing with John Kerry. So I wasn't voting for Republican. I was voting against the Democrats and Republicans. More importantly, I was voting to establish a platform for Ralph Nader and other people who were coming from an independent perspective who would at least have a voice in challenging the status quo. Today, I want Rocky Anderson. I want the head of the Green candidate, the doctor out of Harvard, who has zero platform. I want her. I even want the millions of Ron Paul young idealists who are voting. I want them to all come together, agree what you will disagree with, but agree what you can agree with to create the platform for the next cycle that we can then become a unity party where you bring different people together from different walks of life and say, don't look at us as an ideology, look at us as a series of ideas that deserve to be heard. And that's what we have been lacking in all of this political process, is outside progressive, independent, humanistic, spiritual ideas or ideals. And hence, the moment you start to raise something up, they destroy you. And the very parties that destroy you, the official left and the official right. And that's why I'm so, that's why I believe now is the time to build for the next cycle. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, speaking as someone who's been through that on the ground level, these groups are not going to come together under one nice big umbrella because that was our dream. And I'll tell you, they're very nervous about guarding their turf. I'm not talking about big powers. I'm talking about wonderful grassroots organizations. They have a certain, I hate to use the term brand, but something they're known for, a single-issue campaign or something, and they're very, very nervous about whether they would lose any power or identity if they were to go together in a big coalition. So I don't think that's going to happen. I would rather see that we would get the kind of democracy with proportional representation so there could be minority parties. If you get 5% of the vote, you get 5% of the seats in Congress or your state legislature. It's a perfectly stable system, and it lets new voices into the system. So, of course, there's a whole movement trying to get, well, we have gotten in San Francisco ranked choice voting and working on getting proportional representation. But I don't think the other way is actually going to happen, even though I agree with you that it would be great.
I believe that in the past, you're absolutely correct. I saw it myself. But what we have now is something a little different. We have forums. The Progressive Radio Network is the fastest growing network in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of thousands of people per week downloading shows that were never there. Every single day, thousands upon thousands new voices. I believe that bringing all those progressive leaders together who have their own individual agendas and giving them a form and having articles and documentaries that we didn't used to have. Now we have so much information that people didn't have that is outside of the mainstream, and people are excited by this. I believe that something may germinate from this. At least I'm willing to commit myself to giving it an opportunity before I write it off. Now, that said, my next question for you.
Before you get to the next question, I think you have put your finger on something very important, because the alternative forces never had a good media network when it was a matter of print, magazines, newspapers, and the foundations would never support that. They would give you startup money and you have to be self-sufficient after 3 months. It was kind of maddening that the alternative philanthropists didn't see the need for alternative journals, newspapers, magazines the way they have in Europe. But now, with these internet radio networks, suddenly there is this alternative media network that we couldn't get through the print way 20 years ago. So, yeah, big point.
In fact, 4 months ago, when I founded Progressive Radio Network, I had 21 listeners on my first day. Now, mind you, I was coming from ABC Network, number one show on Sunday evenings in all of America. And BAI and Pacifica, number one there. And I had all the large audiences. So starting something that was an experiment, everyone said no one's going to listen. And if you Googled it back there, you get anywhere from 50 to 100 people if you just put in Progressive Radio. Mm. And on your computer now, if you're at one, why don't you just type in Progressive Radio? See how many hits come up? Just Progressive Radio.
I'm not at one. I don't know if you're talking to listeners or me. I'm not at a computer.
Okay, well, try it. And just now, about 20 minutes ago, it came up 358 million hits. Now, that's everything under Progressive and Radio, but Progressive Radio Network's number one. And the same thing under Liberal Radio. Put in Liberal Radio, and Progressive Radio Network's number one. So what has happened is, quietly under the radar, with no publicity, no interviews, no media at all, mm-hmm. just word of mouth by people who are frustrated at all the things that you have said are limiting, self-limiting in a very hierarchical, very linear way of institutional control. They're breaking free of, and they're doing it quietly, but make no mistake, they are large numbers of people willing to listen to a variety of ideas from people who historically had either had to align themselves with a very radical left or very radical right. No more. You don't have to misalign yourself, especially if there's no ideology, just wonderful ideas. And, mm-hmm. and when you look at how stuck in the mud Pacific and other non-commercial stations are, and they say, gee, why are we losing audience? I said, well, hello, this isn't 1975. Get with the young people today. Get where the energy is going. There's a spiritual energy that is connecting people. It is vital. It is pulsating. Mm-hmm. And it's alive. The heart is alive. For 25 to 30 years, there was no heartbeat. Now there is. So anyhow, that's where I believe we now have a forum, and it's not politically controlled, it's not financially controlled, not a single program on there, except mine ever has to raise a nickel. How about that? Non-commercial radio without any fundraising.
An amazing accomplishment in that short number of years.
Short number of years, but it's exponentially growing now. Just one article we just did challenging Gardasil, and another article that Richard Gale and I did, and Richard's one of our in-house scholars and residents, and we have 5 in-house scholars and residents. That's all they do every day is look at major social issues and look for the truth without aligning themselves politically or ideologically. Just what is the truth on an issue? We had about 40 million people read one publication. You mm-hmm. couldn't have had that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can. In any case, I want to go on because I know that the audience is interested in some of the things that your insights on this, and I'd just like to share a recent study that was just in the news last Thursday. Now, let me summarize the basic quotes from the report, which I feel connects the dots to prove your relational connections between what might on the surface to appear disparate and unrelated. This is LiveScience.com. Are you familiar with them?
No.
Okay. It was a study conducted by neuropsychologist Dr. Gordon Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at Brock University in Ontario, Canada. The quote, it's short. The research findings that children with low intelligence are more likely to hold prejudiced attitudes as adults. Low-intelligence adults tend to gravitate toward socially conservative ideologies. The study found those ideologies in turn stress hierarchy and resistance to change, attitudes that can contribute to prejudice, said Dr. Hudson. A Brian Nosek, a social cognitive psychologist at the University of Virginia, who was not involved in the study, noted, quote, "When one selects intelligence, political ideology, and racism, and looks at any relationship between these three variables, it's about to upset somebody. Polling data and social political science research do show that prejudice is more common in those who hold right-wing ideals than those of other political persuasions," Nosek noted. Hudson was quick to note that despite the link found between low-intelligence social conservatism, the researchers are not implying that all liberals are brilliant and all conservatives stupid. The research is a study of averages over a large group. Now, I recall another recent study at a university showing that conservatives focus on and respond most to negatives, which leads them backwards towards regressive solutions, whereby liberals and progressives will focus and respond more readily towards positives that offer new solutions which have never been tried before. Now, this is where I'm going with this. There are other similar research studies that I'm sure that you're familiar with. So my question is this. If we assume that people are hardwired for being conservative or liberal, selfishly indifferent to the suffering of others, or compassionate and empathetic, then is it realistic to believe that those stuck in a purely mechanistic, regressive view of the world and society can be educated to embrace a more relational perspective and perception of reality? And finally, since you've been a harsh critic of America's dominant educational system and the way we educate young minds, do you feel that if the education system was overhauled in a particular way, we would find less ideological right-wing conservatives and racists in the future? Or do we need to espouse a kind of patient waiting suggested by people like Paul Ray and his theory of cultural creatives, and simply wait until this emergence of new, independent, more holistic people becomes a majority in order to make the fundamental changes being demanded by a society today? Please take your time.
I want to begin by putting another study on the table that's relevant to this. And it was one where, I can't remember the organization, but some research organization asked liberals and conservatives about their views of God and religion in general. And they put a question to them saying, what would happen in your mind, what would you predict if there were no God? And the liberals said, oh, well, I'd be so lonely. I would feel I weren't in communion with the grand forces of the universe. But the conservatives said to the question, what would happen if there were no God? Oh, well, there would be chaos. There would be social breakdown. There would be no need for ethics or right behavior or laws. It would all just crumble, because there's no eternal law making us act good in order to join God in heaven after this life. So I thought that was absolutely fascinating, and I've seen many studies that indicate there's a current of fear underlying that profile you read, that always has to be on guard against other people. Other people are trying to do you in. They're trying to play you for a sucker with your tax money. They're welfare queens. You have to hold them at arm's length and keep them down. And there's one strain in certain religious denominations that emphasize the fallen nature of man, very fallen, and we need God's laws and man-made laws to hold it all together. And then I think the other orientation, and of course this brings to mind George Lakoff's metaphor of the stern, punitive father and the nurturing, maternal figure he sees as the liberals, but in any event, the idea that we can all come into the fullness of our own unfolding as persons, and this can be cultivated, this can be aided, or really repressed and slapped down depending on what kind of society you're born into. And I think that the key might be to prove that a lot of the social programs that enable opportunity for people are indeed making the country safer. There has to be a way to diffuse that fear that undergirds a lot of the prejudicial and conservative views. So I'm very interested in these new studies, like that book, The Spirit Level.
Yes.
And also I think another one is called The Fair Society, that show how damaging it is to a society when you have huge wealth inequality, which we now have, and it's getting worse all the time, again, because of the tax code. When you have that kind of disparity, the levels go up across all the socioeconomic levels with a lot of tension and depression, and it's a situation that's purposely making people miserable. So, of course, they're getting a lot of illnesses, but so is everybody else, because the society is just a pressure cooker. And the few on top, you know, they can only feel safe in very guarded situations. So to make the case that these programs that allow a more equitable society is actually the safer way to go, I think might perhaps win over people who really fear, anything but keeping people under tight control.
Let me expand on that. I think it's fair to say that all ideologies are nested with overlapping beliefs that are relational in many respects. For example, any one of the GOP candidates, at least this is my perspective, represents a nesting of ideologies that reinforce each other. Free market neoliberalism and a belief in regulation as an enemy of growth, and Christian literalism and the belief that the Bible is a basis for the founding of the country, and the entrepreneurial competitive spirit of radical individualism at the expense of altruism and care for those unlucky to partake of the myth of an American dream, and blind patriotism and nationalism regarding international relations and U.S. power, and for the vision you hold of a healthy relational politic. What would you include as the essential beliefs that need to be nested together in order to address the many challenging things that we face?
Well, that's a great question. It brings me back full circle to relational reality, because it is just astounding how little we know about ourselves and the discoveries that are being made at this late date. So I think the more this idea of the isolate self is replaced by the idea of, not the idea, the reality of the way we physically and mentally are so interrelated with the temperature, the air pressure, the amount of light we get every day, the kind of interactions we have with people, whether we have any interactions with people, that's affecting our physiology, our blood pressure, everything. The more it's understood that we are relational beings in every way, and our workplaces and educational places and cities are not set up to acknowledge that that is our nature. As that starts to shift, and it is, that's why I call it the relational shift, which is moving through all the fields right now, is going to really change our sense of what's needed in a human society. Right now, we have an inherited view of what's needed are these tight controls, but I think that's really in the process of shifting.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. I'd like to hear your views on whether we can properly call the United States a democracy. When I look at other countries in Europe and elsewhere in the world, particularly India, I find a much more relational aspect to their political systems. And first, there are many more representative parties in these countries. For example, if you go into India, you have so many parties, including a People's Common Party that's held the national seat and has dominated some of the state politics for decades. In the state of Kerala, which has been ruled by a party for a very long time, you find the highest rate of literacy in India, and particularly among women, which is greater than 90%, and much of the strong social programs for the Keralan population you don't find elsewhere in India. And in Europe, certain regions will have stronger party representation than others. For example, union parties in Germany are stronger in the north industrial areas, whereas the pro-corporate free market parties are strongest in the financial centers, such as Frankfurt. And you can have several dozen parties with some kind of presence and representation in many countries, such as Germany, Italy, France, India. And the advantage of this is coalition building in order to create a majority to challenge a ruling party that is failing. And the result is a greater democracy and representation of popular voices in the governed system. So with this in mind, I'd like to hear you first critique American democracy and then speak, please, on the relational roles third parties, such as the one that you helped form, the Green Party, and even the new Justice Party, can play even if they are unable to win a presidential election because the money and the power is stacked against them by the Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, we inherited this idea of a clockwork universe when our Constitution was written. And the 18th century thinkers were very much influenced by that Newtonian physics and the ideas of the wheels and cogs. And so we have this pretty brilliant system of checks and balances, like a nice big machine, everything checking everything else. But it was never, like the rest of our culture, emphasizing process, unfolding and process and ongoing change. So if we'd had that sense of democracy, that every generation fine-tunes democracy and takes it a little further, we would have a different system today. But instead, you know, there's that wonderful quote by John Adams who said, "I do politics so my sons can do government, so my grandsons can make art." In other words, we set it up, we get it working, and we forget about it. So I think we need to, again, as a corrective contribution in our time, I mean, they were doing the best they could. It was the 18th century, and that's the way the thinking was. But if we want to think about making democracy deeper and more fully effective, there are all kinds of things could be done. It's pretty broken at this point. And a lot of Greens and other alternative people, as I've said, are working on getting district elections in their counties and cities and ranked choice voting, which allows the small party to be, the minor party to be the second one people might vote for. They vote for the top three, and if their first candidate doesn't make it, there's right away they look at the second tier voting. And proportional representation, which, as you say, allows minority parties into the governing forums. And they do form coalitions. Even to get 5% of a national vote takes a lot of coalition building. But the second part of your question about how we could move things right now, I don't know if the Democrats learned a lesson from what happened with the Gore-Nader situation.
They absolutely did not.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, when I was writing Relational Reality and was published in 1997, not Relational Reality, The Resurgence of the Real was published in 1997, so I was finishing writing in 1996, and I had this little story in there with some William Morris coming back. You know, he used as the time traveler of utopian situations, and so I had him coming back to a Midwestern city and seeing what happened. They were explaining to him about the year 2000 election, and in this story, 4 years before the election, I predicted that this Green candidate would be running, and in late October, the Democratic candidate would feel pretty pressured, pretty threatened by him. because he had more than 5% of the votes in a number of states. And so at that point, the candidate in the book, the Al Gore in the book, he said, I'm going to incorporate a lot of, you know, what the Greens want, and I'm going to announce my cabinet, and I'm putting, you know, like Jim Hightower in for Secretary of Agriculture and a number of Green-type people. And then he won the election that way, so there was a Green-Democrat government. But then the situation actually happened. It actually happened then in the third week of October or so in 2000. And I thought for sure that those very expensive campaign advisors around Gore would say, okay, what are the other liberal parties do in Europe when this happens? You know, this must happen a lot to them because the Greens run over there. And a lot of them have first-past-the-post democracies like I do. They don't, like we do, they don't all have proportional representation in Europe. At any rate, what happens is, you know, they have to make concessions to the Green platform. It would have been a simple thing if they'd looked at the model of what has happened over and over again in Europe and said, oh, I see, we have to make concessions. And they were hanging up when Greens were calling them, trying to talk to them. But I wrote an op-ed piece about this in the San Francisco Chronicle after the 2000 election. And I said, Ralph would not have made a deal. But Gore, if people had any smarts around him, what they told him to do, as you remember, every day was just whap, 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 give the Greens the back of your hand in a speech every day, and that will be the lead bit on the news at night. You Greens are just bad environmentalists. You should get back in line with the Democratic Party. We've got environmentalism. I mean, he didn't get anything about community-based economics and the whole critique. But if he'd had anybody around him smart that looked at how this has been done before in Europe, what the model is, he could have said, all right, I understand that the platform is the most important thing to the Greens. It's arrived at democratically through this grassroots process all over the country, and your national platform is really important to you. It's very democratically done. The way to get the Greens is through the platform. So I've read your platform, and I'm going to pledge to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 things that are not in the Democratic platform that I've gotten out of the Green platform. And he would have picked up those votes because no one wanted Bush to get elected. We were a pressure group. We were a very effective pressure group at that time. But instead, they just did that macho kind of smack them down, smack them down, smack them down. And every time he talked that way at a talk against the Greens, the percentage for Nader would go up 3 more points in the states where he had appeared. So they didn't learn even from day to day, you know. And I'm wondering why you feel, I haven't had any communication, why do you feel they haven't learned anything now?
You're right. Final question, and we only have 2.5 minutes before our program's over. I'm very concerned that a large segment of the environmental movement has been substantially co-opted by special interest groups, and I even have proof of this, that large amounts of money have been going into different environmental groups, and that has tempered the attitude towards different polluting industries. Could you give us your view on where the environmental movement stands at this moment, what we need to rejuvenate it?
Well, I just read an article about the Big Ten, who are the major environmental organizations, and they admitted that this tack they've been on for 10 or 15 years has been a mistake, where they would consult with the corporations, sit down with the corporations, you know, work with the corporations. It kind of reminded me of how the Germans tried what was called the march through the institutions in the 70s. You know, let's join the Liberal Party and see what we can do. And the answer was we couldn't do anything, so they started the Greens at the end of the 1970s. Anyway, the Big Ten in the United States kind of had their march through the corporations over the last 12 years. And the interesting thing was this consortium, this meeting they had, said this has been a failed policy on our part. The corporations do not want to work with us. We haven't achieved anything. And we're going to go back to grassroots-based membership movements, you know, against things that are happening in every region, every state, every city. and be activists on that level instead of trying to convince the corporations.
Good.
So I think, you know, if this is true, we're going to see a change for the better.
I'm very supportive of that. Thank you again for coming on. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. You give us such wonderful insights. I really appreciate your presence and your book, Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness That Are Transforming the Modern World, website charlenespretnak.com, Spretnak. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll, and this has been a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. Next week, we have an hour or more devoted to the war on drugs. And we are going to look at this from every possible perspective. How we enabled and abetted the poppy growing and the warlords of the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. We were giving them money at the same time we were saying we're against the war, but we were locking up people using 2 ounces of marijuana in Florida. And think of the consequences of a war that cannot be won, where the demand exceeds the supply. And instead of looking at it as we did with alcohol and the dangers of prohibition and what it caused, we continue to enable it. Anyhow, I have a whole panel coming on to talk about that next week. And then we carry on with other very important original investigative reports and social issues where we can take our time and lay them out. Also, our new studio was erected today. I'm very excited about this. It's a beautiful studio. And once we get all of our cameras in place and microphones and test it out, my hope is the latter part of this week we'll actually be able to go live. As right now, I'm in our smaller studio with a camera. Wait till you see the big one. It's going to look terrific. Look forward to sharing more with you on our next program tomorrow. Thank you all very much for listening. Have a nice day.